The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
You're listening to Monocle on Design, and I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show...
I created my theory or my approach by observing life in India. And so the kind of thing that I do don't follow the norm that has been written or typed or talked about as the meaning of aesthetics or meaning of a particular character.
We sit down for a lively long-form interview with the Indian architect Balkrishna Doshi, this year's Pritzker Prize laureate. Plus, an aside, we ask, who are the Pritzkers and why is their approval so prized? All that coming up right here on the next half hour on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, 90 years of age, Balkrishna Doshi is the first Indian architect to garner architecture's highest honour. Despite never receiving a formal education in the field, Doshi's career saw him work with the 20th century's most significant makers, including Le Corbusier and Louis Kahn. B.V. Doshi, as he's often known, may have rubbed shoulders with notables of the US and European architecture circuit, but the Pune-born maestro's own groundbreaking designs are all built on Indian soil. His oeuvre and seven-decade career is understandably hard to pigeonhole, ranging as it does from business schools in Bangalore, think greenery, gardens and lots of open corridors, to affordable housing in central India. His aim is always to democratise design, usually with a generous modernist bent to the execution, and in a way that honours the climate, culture and creativity of his home nation and country folk. We caught up with a surprisingly sprightly nonagenarian recently to discuss his long career and being awarded this year's Pritzker Prize in Architecture. Here, Balkrishna Doshi speaks to Monocle's Tomas Lewis.
It's like a crown that you get to wear when you are sufficiently old. And it's one of the most important thing for me because I happened to be also on the jury 12 years ago. So I know what the prize means and what the value of the prize is. Significance of that. And for me, the significance is that this is the first time in India an Indian is getting a prize from the world, which recognizes that there is an architecture that is being done in India by somebody who has some significance. And I think this whole idea of significance would then filter down. And the newspaper, the media, the politicians, the developers, and everybody else will start talking that there is something called architecture. And I think for a country like India, where ancient architecture is very, very prominent, and there is also the European and Corbusier's work, but this one comes as a surprise, but I think it's a very good thing, and it will trigger a lot of new imagery and I think aspirations. And that is the meaning for me.
You were asked whether the fact that your buildings are all in India, that you hadn't built elsewhere, whether that was important to you, and your answer was a very clear yes. Explain that a little bit, if you could.
You know, there is so much to do in our own country. It's not a small place, it's a continent, large population, and a billion people. So billion people with billion aspirations. So if one wants to do work, you don't need to go out. The market is full of people and their aspirations. And each region has different characteristics. So if I want to work in India, I have innumerable choices. If I go to south, I see a very different world. If I go to north, northeast, west, another world. So if I have that kind of a choice, not traveling much. And second thing is, because we are not technologically highly technical, the regional characteristics can be expressed through local things. And that gives me a satisfaction that I have done something which will appear rooted to the place. And I think that rooting is very important for me, that it doesn't look like an outside. It should give a sense of timelessness. And that is what I am interested in, that if you go to a place in India, and when you go to the deserts and you see the mud houses and beautifully done, if I have to do a building there, it should merge with it. And that is quite different from a metropolis. So choices I have many, opportunities are many. So I don't need to go out.
You mentioned during your lecture about creating spaces where surprises could happen, and that that had imbued itself in projects from university campuses to, I think it was a business complex, to a water tower, yeah, even. Why is the notion of a built environment being a canvas for surprises and for life to unfold so important to you, I suppose, in your work? But also, do you think that's something that you have seen in other architectural practices elsewhere? Is there a sense that, you know, sometimes architecture can box us in? And is that something you were sort of pushing against?
I think sense of belonging is very important. And sense of belonging can only come when you connect them through the emotional values of the people. Second thing is participation. The third issue is familiarity, yet it is something slightly different. So that enigma has to come in. And I think that I find in India very important, especially when large population is there, which has different kind of cultural backgrounds. And if they come there, then the whole question is, how would the spaces and form or space, light or values be seen? And I think nature also in India plays a very important role, very harsh light or soft light, landscape changes, people are different things. And so if you see examples of the Hindu, temples, I think temples are great examples because you all the time feel movement, change, and affinity. And I think that is something which I think I try to do in the work. And that fascinates me because it is in this place, it's only chance. Also, the technology that I use is not really in terms of very modern or something, because I thought that I would like to make a lot of diversities, variations. So if you use a technology and if you want to talk about productive technology, then one doesn't get that sense of that little variation. Like if you walk on the streets, you find so many kinds of faces, so many dresses, so many languages, so many gestures. Now, is it possible that we can make a building like the beings? So I tried to create a static theater of Indian culture.
You worked famously with many of the great figures of architecture in the 20th century, Le Corbusier being among them. What struck me during your lecture was, I suppose, the intimacy of that relationship. One thing, I suppose, that to perhaps a layperson about his body of work is that there was a sort of element, I suppose, of prescription, of deciding that this was a new way of living and that this is how a new way of life should be lived. It strikes me that your work is quite different to that. You spoke about your vast work in social housing and that at the heart of those designs was this sense that the people who lived there should be able to build on top of what you'd designed. Yeah. Was there any tension there between you and Le Corbusier, or was his thinking something that was a bit of a springboard to your mind of the flexibility that architecture could have?
Actually, I knew Corbusier, I can't say very closely, but reasonably closely. And my relation with him was almost like my grandparent, you know. So learning from him, talking to him, and if I did something, then he would come and draw and change and tell me about India. He was the first one to tell me about India and Indian life. He said, you know, in your country, have you noticed the birds fly through the house? Have you noticed the trees and the wind? How harsh the sun is? And then he would point out people there, and he says, this is really strong, but this is really very soft. So he says, don't you see the dynamic balance? Then he would say that if you have to eat food, it may be good that sometimes in one place there is more salt, and in the other part there is no salt. Now he would talk to me like this. So if he was telling me this way, what better lesson I can get but to understand this and transfer this into life, transfer it into work, transfer it into my kind of idea, that paradox, choice, variety, and the game that you play and the delight that you get out of changing situations. And I think this is what I learned from him. So for me, he was that kind of a person. Similarly, Louis Kahn, when he came, I worked with him close to 12 years. I don't think people in Philadelphia worked that long. So I had a stretch of time with him. And the 1 week that he would come, almost full day I would be with him. So he would talk about the break. Then he would talk about Arabian Nights. He would talk about food. He would talk about what is purity. And then I would take him to old houses. I would take him to a temple and a mosque. And we would talk about the spirituality of matter, simplicity of structure. So we talked about many things together. So there was a dialogue which was quite good, and I think it was very amazing that I had that, what you call privilege, that I talked to him and they talked to me as if that they were giving me guidance. So they became my guides. And so the only way was, having got this kind of information, the insight, how would I express it and what is my background? So anything that I was doing came from these two combinations, and naturally what I do has to be close to my work. And that is the only reason why the work is different.
That was Indian architect Balkrishna Doshi speaking to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis. We'll have part two of the interview coming up in just a few short moments. Do stay with us. Now, Doshi's win this year marks the 40th anniversary of the Pritzker Prize, an accolade that's become the most coveted, feted, and fawned over affair in all of architecture. But how much do we know about the Pritzker family, and who decides on who scoops the prize? We asked Monocle's Thomas Lewis to dig a little deeper and find out just a little bit more.
When the idea of a new architecture prize was first mooted in the 1970s, it was brought to Jay and Cindy Pritzker, who'd begun making their fortunes a decade or so previously with the Hyatt Hotel Group. It was the notion that architecture did not have a prize in stature and influence that recognised living practitioners of the craft that drew the two to the idea of backing one. J. Paul Getty was among the financiers who turned the idea of funding such a prize down, and that's where the Pritzkers came in, informed by the architecture of their burgeoning hotel business, in part by how the design of the Hyatt's now distinctive atriums changed the experience of the buildings for the people who came to stay in them.
Together, they had the idea that architecture was the one art that wasn't really dealt with through the Nobel Prize system, and they embraced the idea.
Martha Thorne, speaking on the line from Madrid, is the executive director of the Pritzker Architecture Prize.
It was an art that was gaining more and more importance. They wanted there to be debate and discussion within the public and the news media. They thought that this would be something very positive for the field. And I also think they understood, as they are great philanthropists, that it would be something that they could be close to and nurture and help develop over the years.
That sense of nurturing the field and the works of architecture garlanded by the prize were crystallized in the form of a mission statement. The purpose of the prize, it reads, is to honour a living architect or architects whose built work demonstrates a combination of those qualities of talent, vision and commitment which has produced consistent and significant contributions to humanity and the built environment through the art of architecture. Those high ideals would be accompanied by $100,000, a bronze medallion, and a ceremony in the laureate's honour at a venue of architectural merit somewhere around the world.
Well, I think the Pritzker today remains, without question, the most prestigious prize in the profession.
Alex Bezikovic is the architecture critic for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper.
It is the singular mark of stardom in architecture. I think you could argue that the value of stardom in architecture has declined a little bit, or perhaps that the idea of the star has declined, but you know that remains, and the Pritzker remains at the heart of that economy of stardom.
Was the Pritzker Prize, at some points in its history, responsible in fostering this idea of the rock star architect, or was it catching up and bestowing this prize on people it felt it sort of missed out slightly? What was the dynamic there, do you think?
Well, I think that when we talk about the starchitect, which is a word that is one groans to use, but you know that idea really dates from the mid-1990s, and it was above all other people Frank Gehry, who embodied this idea of architecture becoming a force of broader cultural relevance and of the individual architect acquiring the status of elite artist, perhaps above the level of some of the world's most elite visual artists. And by the time Frank Gehry became sort of a singular star, he had already won the Pritzker. And I think in many cases that has already been true. It was true with Foster, with Rogers, with Zaha Hadid, all of which is to say that winning the Pritzker is clearly a mark of respect within the profession. And it seems to be sort of a prerequisite to that rise to an even broader level of prominence. And so you could certainly see the Pritzker as a critical taste-making device or a critical sort of signaling device as to who matters in the world of architecture.
The roster of Pritzker Prize laureates reads as something of a who's who of the field in the 20th and 21st centuries. But that sense of who matters in the world of architecture has drawn some criticism in the past, most notably due to the low number of women who've been awarded the prize, but also the prominence of white European and North American architects who've won it. The 2018 Pritzker Prize was awarded to the 90-year-old Indian architect Balkrishna Doshi, celebrated for his work on social housing developments in India. He's the first architect from India to have been awarded the prize.
I think it would be a really great moment, if I could be a bit critical, a great moment for the Pritzker to reevaluate its criteria and the kind of values that it wants to promote.
Esther Choi is an architectural historian based in New York City.
There are a lot of problems with the profession. I think in a lot of ways, architecture of all the design disciplines for some reason has lost touch with the fact that it actually is a design discipline, and design by its, you know, very nature, by its definition really, is a problem-solving tool, or I think should be thought of as that. And I think oftentimes that, especially with the way that architecture is discussed in schools, becomes a kind of like, you know, an opportunity for formal innovation, a kind of like making something for the sake of making it, but it's not necessarily actually addressing real constraints, real-time processes, and real problems. So I think in that regard, some of the values or some of the concerns that the Pritzker could, you know, consider are questions like the commissioning systems of architecture, given that right now I think architects feel very beholden to developers and operating in a very neoliberal kind of economy. And are there ways in which architects could be more entrepreneurial to fight against some of these kinds of very commercial corporate interests and really think towards constituencies of like who buildings are built for and what they're built for? I think those kinds of issues, as well as like questions around, you know, how buildings are made, very simply.
To answer that question, we have to remember that in some ways the Pritzker Architecture Prize may be a leader of the discussions or the conversations.
Martha Thorne, the executive director of the Pritzker Architecture Prize.
But sometimes it reflects a context. It reflects ideas that are already out there and maybe echoes some of those debates or takes them a little bit further.
It's that, then, that may colour the Pritzker Prize as it marks its 40th anniversary and looks ahead. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Tomos Lewis.
And we're back now to rejoin the interview with Indian architect B.V. Doshi.
I was interested to look at, staying with the idea of housing with such a prominent social component as you've become so known for, You showed some of these complexes when they were first built and when you designed them, and you also showed them during the lecture this week how they are now. And this notion of the owners have built and added and painted and changed and shops have opened and life has kind of woven itself through. I'm interested to know about notions of control from your point of view as the architect. Is it difficult to design something where at the very core of the design you are relinquishing control, and that that's where the sort of heart of the design lies, is that you want the people who use and live in these buildings to create something of their own from it?
You know, in India, the aesthetic sense is very, very different. We don't have that kind of formulation of aesthetics. Aesthetics is a living entity. It is not a frozen thing. So the Indian theory is that all the human beings have different emotions, and you can express many emotions. The way you express is very important. So the whole question of aesthetics and architecture has to be of a kind or of one kind, as if it is a religion. I think that doesn't exist in Indian culture. It is the delight that is important, not the kind of formulation. So if you have an Indian plate to eat, you get variety of it, and then you choose the way to mix it your way. So you are satisfied through your combination and giving your delight that you were seeking. While in the European dish, you will not get that choice. It is the cook and the chef who has done it. And the way it is presented to you, you have to take it that way. I think this is a fundamental difference between the notion of aesthetics between the East and the West. And I think I was trying to find out, if that is the case, then isn't it possible, like in Indian music, that you can combine and then play the game so that you will get what we call a jugalbandi, the kind of dialogue or the duet, which orchestrates in a very different way. And then, you know, you find that that is something very beautiful. So my effort has been to give only hint and let the choice be with the onlooker or the person who is relishing it.
Is that something, looking at architecture in India now, it's a country with an economy that's booming for many people, I suppose not for everybody. In terms of the architecture that's being built for a country that is going through so many dramatic changes on so many levels, are you sort of energized or concerned about maybe, you know, with wealth, with development, with opportunity, are there architectural ideals that are being relinquished just from your vantage point? Or is there something in the architecture that's happening there now, in the development that's happening across the country now, that chimes with some of the ideas you've expressed throughout your career?
I think this is a very difficult thing that is happening. Unfortunately, I had the grace of having those two masters, and the other one was that I was not fully educated in architecture or anything. So I have a vague notion of what the reality is or what theory is. So I created my theory or my approach by observing life in India. And so the kind of thing that I do don't follow the norm that has been written or typed or talked about as the meaning of aesthetics or meaning of a particular character. Either it is a reinterpretation of function or technology or the kind of space we do. Other thing is that in the kind of visits that I have done to Indian villages and towns and cities, I have seen people using spaces which are not informed. They are really free, and you choose them the way they want, or you give them a choice and it becomes something else. So transformation, according to us, is the law of nature. So they get transformed, they get changed, because they want them to become part and parcel of whole. So the architectural practice that is happening today in India is not like this. It is the way anywhere else it is done, because they don't think like this. They think as an architect who has to have certain ways, certain aesthetics, certain functions, And so they do like that, in which what they have learned, what they have seen in the world, they think that is what they want to do. So they are following that kind of pattern. I am following a pattern which is my own from the two great masters, but again my own in India, trying to really create and discover for myself whether I am understanding really India or not. So it is not meant for demonstration. It is my exploration of thinking that this is perhaps the approach that we should have to give us our own identity and connect us through our sensibilities. So it is really talking matter versus soul. I work with the other, the soft aspect.
And I suppose you're saying, therefore, that the harder aspects,
yes,
money, finance, yeah, those things,
exist.
No. I wanted to ask you briefly, I know our time together is coming to a close. The Venice Biennale this year is looking at notions of free space and interpreting that pretty broadly, I think it's fair to say. What do those words put together mean to you, free space? It seems to me that it is a phrase that resonates quite clearly in a big diversity of your work. What do you think that means today?
Well, it is now coming to the idea that how does one give freedom? Free space is really giving freedom within a certain confinement. And this is a very ancient view. Even if you go to Venice, you will find that kind of a thing happening. There are so many accidental spaces that have happened. It is like we are discovering now, after so centuries, after working with our mechanical ways, we are trying to say, oh my God, but this is something which is liberating us. So my interpretation is that the free space is the attempt to liberate us from the kind of confines that we are traditionally taught. So it is loosening up the attitude on the judgment of what is aesthetics, what is plan, what is function. I think we talk about them in singular ways, but actually each word has to have a lot of plural meanings. And I think those plural meanings are now becoming apparent slowly. We are awakening to plurality, not singularity.
And where are you seeing that plurality opening up, would you say, from your role as a teacher, I suppose? But are there any sort of cities or developments or areas of the world, corners of India, that you're seeing, a sense of an opening up and maybe a pursuit again of imagination in architecture rather than the sort of hard commercial aspect, I suppose, you're alluding to?
I tell you, one of the most fascinating cities in India is Varanasi, Banaras, very ancient city, fully crowded, full of religions, full of feelings, full of emotions, and lot of unmeasurable impact. And I think that is really where the things are, that we are still away from our soul, our inner consciousness. We are still talking as if, you know, that we are talking from our head, body, or the rationale of living. And I think that is where the difference is. We should not really talk about all the time the measurable, the rational, the conventional, in a sense, that what is correct is correct, what is right and wrong. I think there is nothing like right and wrong. It's a completely fluid aspect because it goes from one end to the other, and it is like a glide, you know, you slide slowly from one end to the other end. And for me, I think architecture and life, they also must go like that slide. They go together, and without knowing, they reach a destination which they had not expected.
That was this year's Pritzker Prize winner, Balkrishna Doshi, speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis. Next week,
we found a plan chest, pulled open the drawer and found original stamped buildings from the Smithsons office. I mean, I'm tingling even remembering it.
We take a tour of the former Economist Plaza in London to learn about how to give old buildings a new lease of life. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fannett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.